This episode of The Slow Good Life is brought to you by Slow Talk Podcasting, a turnkey recording studio featuring podcast development, production, distribution, and marketing. Check out Slow Talk Podcasting online at slowtalkpodcasting.com or call them at 805-234-5056. All right. Hey, coming at you from Slow Talk Studios here in lovely Atascadero, California, San Luis Obispo County, Slow Good Life. And tonight, our co-host, Craig Marshall, you just saw Craig, wired everything up.
Wonderful to be here, James.
And in the studio, our friend and musician, many other hats.
Writer, producer, bassist, guitarist, activist.
Fisherman. Steve Miller Band. Yeah. Kenny Lee Lewis. Kenny, welcome to Slow Talk.
Thank you. Thanks for having
yeah,
me.
Yeah, good to have you, man.
Yeah, we've been wanting to get you up here for a while, so it's a pleasure to finally meet you, you know?
Yeah, I'm glad we worked it out. I'm in between touring, and this was a good time.
Got to
yeah.
grab Kenny when he's in between stuff, man, you know? Yeah. You get like a two-week window, and then he does all kinds of fun things and slow. Kenny, you've been busy lately with projects and gigs and fishing and all kinds of fun stuff, man.
Yeah, gardening. Well, there's not much time left, you know what I mean? If you saw one of the posts I put on Facebook earlier, it's my... you know, the Grim Reaper clock that I brought back from Carnarvon, Wales you know, has that really, you know, it's got the clock in the chest and it's just like looking at you like, there's not much time left, you know. And there's a fishing lure now hanging on it and it says so many fish, so little time. So I just put that up. So that's the reason why I'm busy, because I'm thinking in terms of, man, I got so many things that I got to do before I make that transition.
Our list. List.
And I have a lot of personal friends that are passing right now.
That's a crazy thing in our lives when you get to that realm and you have people that are...
So it kind of accelerates the activities, you know, especially when you got the wheels and the health.
Right.
Well, we truly appreciate you carving out time to come up tonight and just be part of the Slow Good Life.
Did I make you feel sufficiently guilty with my speech? No. I'm very happy to be here. I have the time. And that's what's nice about this time right now is I am in between tours, so I can go out and tiptoe through the tulips, literally, you know, in the backyard and work on gardening projects and stuff. And then producing bands and rehearsing bands and playing live with bands and, you know, and just, you know, cooking, you know. Just made some killer stir fry a minute ago.
Cooking Kenny. And I saw you made some salsa for the band practice.
Yeah,
well,
I had some guacamole with the fresh cilantro from my raised bed garden.
Awesome.
Good stuff, man.
Hey, I want to first start off with, you know, we'll talk about what brought you to the Central Coast, how long you've been here and all that. But I want to talk about your formidable years growing up, playing music. What spurned you to pick up a guitar in the first place? I mean, what was the process there? I mean, as a young guy.
Spurn is a good word.
Yeah?
Because my brother and sister were folkies. Mm. And they were playing all the Peter, Paul, and Mary, and, you know, and Ian and Sylvia, and some Dylan, and some Mamas and Papas. And they would perform for my family at our parties that we had during the holidays. They weren't professionals, but they were pretty good singers. My grandmother was a singer, and she taught theater, she taught accordion, and she taught Hawaiian lap steel slide guitar.
What a mix.
Diverse things. And I didn't get on the lap steel slide guitar part of it, but she slapped that accordion on me, I'll tell you that.
That's
right
pretty
now,
cool,
I was
man.
About six. Mm-hmm. But I failed miserably, and she didn't like the way I looked either. So she says, he'll never make it in the music business, you know. And she's with me now, which is funny because she's feeling really guilty, you know, that she said all that stuff when she was alive.
And here you are,
professional. But she's with me all the time now, which is pretty funny. Her name is Thelma. Yeah. And she was a silent movie actress in a few movies and stuff.
Okay.
And
did
her
you...
sisters. So that being said... She taught my brother and sister a little bit about singing and stuff. And so they were already ready and primed for the folky era. And they were really good. They were singing some nice harmonies, you know, Hang Down Your Head, Tom Dooley, you know, Michael, Row Your Boat Ashore. You know, it's like, you know, they did Puff the Magic Dragon, man, all the hits, you know, from that era. So I was 6 years younger than my sister. And my brother was even older. And I was too small. so I couldn't participate.
Puff the Magic Dragon with an accordion, for the record?
No, they were playing guitar. My brother had a $40 nylon string silver tone guitar he bought at Sears for $40 when he was going to college. I still have that. It's in the house.
Really?
Yeah, he gave it to me. So I was jealous, and I was spurned because I couldn't participate. So I begged an aunt to give me a Martin ukulele she had up high in her closet, left over from the 20s when she was at college, you know, when they used to wear beaver coats and all that. Yes, there are no bananas, you know, and all its songs, you know. So she had one of those, and it was a Martin. And I didn't know that at that time as a little kid, but I knew that my hands were small enough to be able to play that thing. So I kept bugging her. She lived in Berkeley, and we'd go over and visit her from Sacramento, where I grew up, was 5 or 6. Mm-hmm. And so, anyway, started in ukulele. Is that ukulele? Sounds like ukulele. Anyway, I learned ukulele. I bought a book, and I started learning on my own. So I wanted to get into the Lewis family music business, which was to play at these parties. And I learned all these old black spirituals and stuff, and learned where the dots went. I got a felt pick, and I, you know, at 6, 7 years old, I was singing songs for the family now. Wow. And they were like, well, where in the heck did he get that? You know, because I, you know, saved up a little money from, you know, gifts at Christmas stuff, and I bought a ukulele book, a really, really old kind of Mellow Bay kind of, you know, ukulele book. And that's how I started. And so, because I was spurned, because I was jealous, because I was the baby and I wanted to be involved.
Wanted to join the band. Yeah, yeah, man. The ukulele.
Just wanted to get some attention.
Now, Kenny, do you still have that ukulele?
No. Yeah. I had to trade that with a whole bunch of other stuff when I got my first Strat. Yeah. That's a long story.
Yeah, yeah. That's another one of your collections.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of I'm glad you asked that about his roots, because, wonder where this talent came from. And to hear about your family and then marrying Diane, and the other night seeing Diane and the Barflies at D'Ambino's, my gosh, what a show. And some of the best versions of Old Man and by Neil Young, and then Bill Withers' song, Use Me. Mm-hmm. Just this deep blue, funky, soulful thing. Mm-hmm. And she got into a little bit about her roots, and I thought, boy, there's a catalog there to tap into. And that was just one incredible part of the show. Just really enjoyed that.
Her family's pedigree is unbelievable. I mean, we haven't even told the story yet of her family with another family called the Newborn family. And they were both in Memphis during the late 40s as jazz swing musicians. But they, you know, what happened after World War II is, you know, bands started getting smaller rhythm sections. They didn't want to pay for the big band budgets. So they did smaller rhythm sections, and they started doing a little more boogie-woogie. And when they started doing the boogie-woogie, the people really started, because, you know, they're coming out of the jitterbug era. People that didn't even jitterbug during the war now were doing it because it was the hip thing to do, because the race, you know, art from the big cities and the clothing and the music and everything permeated into the suburbs. And because Army guys had hung out with black people in the service during the war, they were more apt to be able to, you know, embrace the culture, you know. Yeah. So this was before rock and roll, though. I mean, this was swing musicians playing boogie-woogie with small rhythm sections. Then they started going and buying, like, really loud suits at a place called Lansky's, which was on Beale Street in Memphis. And this is about 47. And Diane's father was a great prodigy trumpet player. And he was the 17-year-old lead trumpet player of a band called Tough Green and the Rocketeers.
Oh, nice.
And you can Google that. Okay. And Tough Green was the first bass player to start playing the bass kind of like with that style where you pull on the downbeat and let it go on the upbeat, which all the rockabilly bass players do. He was one of the first guys to start doing all that stuff.
Wow.
Plus, he'd like get together with the Newborn family, and they were nuts. And Calvin on guitar, and Phineas Newborn Jr., was a prodigy piano player. And then the father was in Lionel Hampton's band playing all these really hip beats. Wow. You know, Hey Bop, Rebop. That's arguably with the first rock and roll songs, Hey Bop, Rebop by Lionel Hampton. And so my father-in-law also was playing with him, too.
That's pretty crazy.
So, but Tough Green, in 1947, Mose Allison is quoted as saying that when he saw Tough Green and the Rocketeers in 1947, which my father-in-law was playing trumpet in, he said, as far as he was concerned, that that was the first rock and roll band he ever saw.
Wow.
That was 1947.
Wow.
That was 6 years before Elvis even moved, Memphis.
Pretty crazy to hear that story about what was bubbling up in other parts of the country.
Yeah, Beale Street in Memphis. Nobody went down there because it was, you know,
that part of town.
You didn't go down there. Yeah. It was the hood. So as all this great stuff was going down there, you missed out because you weren't down there.
I just heard a little Ray Charles talking about Elvis, and Ray Charles was a little critical of Elvis, but he was very polite the way he said it. But he talked about the role of Elvis to shine the light on the music. But he talked about the broad spectrum of music going on. Of course, Elvis did introduce a wider audience, but the roots of that music.
Well, let me finish the story, because Elvis shows up now, and he goes and hangs out with the Steinberg family and the Newborn family, and I have all this in a new documentary I'm working on now called It's All Green, and he was kind of like a village idiot that used to just kind of like bug the hell out of these two families, because he loved their music so much, and he'd moved to town. He started going to their church. He was listening to them play live all the time. My father-in-law wore these really great, beautiful suits. He had black hair with this waterfall hairdo that came down, and he played great trumpet and looked really sexy on stage, and Elvis wanted to be my father-in-law. They both got signed to Sam Phillips at the same time, and my father-in-law was supposed to be the great light-skinned black dude that sounded like, you know, black music, but looked like a white guy, looked like Don Ameche. So Elvis was just this white kid that didn't know how to sing or do anything yet.
Wow.
And so they had to develop him as an artist. And the Steinberg and the Newborn family, along with Sam Phillips and all those people, sort of helped him along, because he was a nice kid and he was willing to listen. And he was a sponge, you know. Yeah. So this documentary I'm working on is going to tell the whole story of how these two families basically made him. And this is way before Colonel Parker.
This is fascinating because a lot of folks are really enjoying the documentary as a form.
Nobody knows the story. Scorsese doesn't know the story. Ken Burns doesn't know this story. They don't know it because it's never been told, because it's just been kind of like a secret down in Memphis for years.
Benford Stanley doesn't know this story yet. No. He's working on the Jimmy Rogers documentary.
Well, I think I've told Ben this story. Right. I think he knows it. All right. But it's coming out, and we have a documentary lady that we're working with. I have to decide if I want to pay the extra money and have her go write a grant for us so we can get the money, so we can start doing the documentary, and then do the dramatized novel and do kind of a Cadillac Records kind of movie with it, because that would be what this would be. And it's amazing. And again, this does not take anything away from Elvis. He was talented. He was good looking. He listened. He learned from those guys. Calvin, the guy, the guitar player, just mentioned, he was the one that was doing the hip movements. Uh-huh. Elvis was watching him and going, how do you do that? It looked like you disconnected your pelvis.
Kind of reminds me of Mick Jagger seeing James Brown at the Tammy show.
Yeah.
And what he picked up.
And
from
also
James
Forrest
Brown.
Gump with the braces. I mean, it's not that far from that story. I swear to
That's
God.
That's incredible. We're looking forward to hearing and maybe reading and seeing this someday.
Right.
Kenny.
But I don't want to go off on a tangent on that, but I wanted to, since you were already bringing up Elvis, I want to let you know that the story I was telling was involving him too.
That's a crazy connection, real close, right around the corner.
And he used to tell the story about meeting and being with all those people and going to dinner at their houses and asking questions. When Colonel Parker took over in 1956, Elvis did an interview in 1956 on the Charlotte Observer. You can Google it. It's an interview with Elvis where he starts talking about, there's all these black guys I'm hanging out with down on Beale Street, and I just took what they had been doing all along, and I just goosed it up a little bit.
Wow, what a story. Next time
That's on the internet. You can look that up.
Hey, Kenny, come back.
And then the colonel said, you can't tell that story anymore.
Yeah.
Because you got to be the king.
Wow.
Because it was Jim Crow, and he had to be the king. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it was.
When you come back, please bring Diane Steinberg Lewis to tell us the story also. And to give her. Yeah, that's powerful, man.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
Wow. It's very powerful.
I had to learn this over many, many years of hanging out with her and her family. But her family, they're very kind of quiet about it. They don't really go off and on about it so much. I mean, down there, they're kind of like at a different wavelength down there. Mm. They're not all hyper like us West Coast, left Coast people.
But there's a rich tradition there that they hold on to.
But they also are very private people, and they don't want to go into great detail about it. Some of it's a little hurting because, you know, their families were the ones that really invented rock and roll. But Elvis got the credit along with, not just him, but... when the Delta Cats came into the studio at Sun and they recorded Rocket 88 in 1951, guess who the backup band that went out and supported Jackie Prince's tour? The Newborn family. It was Calvin and his father and his brother. They were the backup band for Jackie Brinson.
Wow.
And they were a swing jazz bunch. But because they could play that boogie-woogie so badass.
They were looking for that hip.
That was the stuff. And that was, you know, what Finest was doing on the piano.
Yeah.
Because he was a classically trained bebop player.
Yeah.
He was out. He went to, you know, Harlem later in 56. And he was like the toast of the town. Art Tatum wouldn't even follow him. That's how heavy he was.
Wow.
But they were the guys that backed Jackie Brinson on the 51 Rockin' 88 tour.
Nice.
You know, so all these jazz cats were tied into R&B. And then, of course, Stax came later, which their family was also involved with, because we talked about Green Onions the other night, if you remember that. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other story. But their family was there at every single point of time throughout history, going back 100 years to W.C. Handy, because her grandfather played piano and co-wrote songs with W.C. Handy.
This is like a charm bracelet, really. It's really like a musical charm bracelet.
I mean, I get goosebumps Incredible just thinking roots. About it, you know. So, anyway, that just gives you a little sample of what's coming with this documentary work.
I'm going to be awesome. Forward to that, man.
Yes. Right now, the working title is All Green, because it's got nothing to do with being black or white. It has to do with the money. And WDIA, which was the first station in that town to ever have black people on the radio like we're doing right now, they were never allowed to do this.
Wow.
And WDIA in 1948 was the very first station to ever have a completely black programmed and run station, even though it was white owned.
And at that time, that was major, that broke ground, that was done.
It's invented rock and roll. It went into the suburbs.
Powerful.
That's how we got where we are. That's how I have a job. Yeah. That's why I want to do this documentary, because I'm really honoring I have a job.
The roots of your heritage.
Yeah, yeah.
Musically and family, that's powerful.
Yes.
That's really powerful.
So your union with Diane, I mean, you're in the Barflies together, and we can talk about a little bit about her history, too. I mean, I don't know a lot about Diane, but I do know she's a great musician. And you know, growing up as a kid, I mean, you know, I was 12 years old when I saw her in Sgt. Pepper, the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people know her from that. I mean, that's just a small sampling. But why don't you share a little bit about her history, too?
Well, I mean, at the tail end of that story,
her mom
became a very famous radio DJ who went into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Martha Jean the Queen Steinberg, as of Memphis, as of Detroit. The father, Luther, was a great jazz trumpet player. He did great, but when Elvis hit, he didn't really think it was going to happen because he just kind of looked at it like a fluke, you know, because he was a bebop cat, you know, and he was doing Dizzy Gillespie gigs. They were both trading high chairs for Cab Calloway and Basie and Lionel Hampton.
Wow.
So they were the two hip trumpet players. But nobody knows about my father-in-law because he never made it big. He just stayed in Memphis. You know, he just kind of did the South Swing tours or whatever. But then they had Diane. Both Martha and Luther had Diane. And Diane was trained with Finus Newborn, that great piano player I talked about. She was sitting in his laps at 12 years old playing Rhapsody in Blue and learning how to read.
That's crazy.
You know, fly poop, as they call it. You know? And she could, that's what she does up here in SLO. She does all the accompaniment for a lot of churches and choirs and schools and stuff. And she's got a job at Cuesta doing like, kind of like an adult pop rock for school of rock kind of thing that they're doing. In fact, they have a show tonight at Cuesta with the graduating class, and she does it every semester.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So she reads really well. She can read every kind. And she puts feel into it because she's got that Southern Memphis feel on the keyboard. So, but she went right out of college into teaching, but then got involved in the theater programs out there in Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids. In fact, we're going there on Sunday, just out of coincidence. And she did so well in the plays as a student actor, like a student teacher actor. Mm-hmm. People just go, man, you should move to Hollywood, man. She was writing songs. She was playing a place called the Whistle Stop in Kalamazoo. And they she got a record deal through her mom and did a record at the Philly Sound with Tom and Tony Bell on Atlantic. So she got a deal with Atlantic.
Wow.
With Ahmed Erdi and all those folks.
Oh, yeah.
So that was about 73 or 4. And then she moved out to California, got a deal with ABC Dunhill, and that's when I met her. Okay. And she hired me as her bass player, and then ended up co-writing and ended up doing that record together, which brought me into the studio business down in L.A. as a session player, you know, with all the guys in Toto and those people and stuff, because I got kind of in on the tail end of that whole golden era of studio musician stuff. I wasn't in the Wrecking Crew, but I was in a couple other rhythm sections, did quite a few records and stuff.
That's cool. Yeah.
But that's when I met her. She hired me as a bass player. But then she went on, and we were getting ready to go out and tour with George Benson to promote this new record of hers called Universal Child, which you can Google and listen to on YouTube. But she got the audition for Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds with the movie. She got it. She beat out Donna Summer and Carly Simon and a whole bunch of people that were going for that role. And Stigwood just loved her. And we thought the movie was going to be huge because everything Stigwood touched
I did too.
Huge.
Right. I thought
so
it was going
to
be.
So she just had to make a really big decision. I mean, now she's got her big record. She's got, you know, she's going to go out and open for George Benson. We're getting ready to tour. We got our band together. We even had Steve Perry as our bongo player and background singer before he was in Journey. Because he was a friend of mine that I grew up with in the San Joaquin Valley.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he never even got a chance to even rehearse with us, because by the time she got this thing, we had to even just cancel the rehearsal he was going to play on. But he was looking forward to making the money, you know. So we had to disband the band, and she went and did this movie with Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees.
1977, 78?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, Robert Stigwood, Stigwood Productions. He did a lot of
But she was a
films.
Songwriter, and she was very knowledgeable of publishing and copywriting, and she hit me to all that and got me started in the songwriting business. And so
session playing, you mentioned, you know, you meet Toto, the guys in Toto's. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've played with, Bonnie Raitt, what, she's kind of like a sister to you, isn't she?
Not really a sister. Yeah. We've just played together.
Have you played together?
Yeah. She's done a couple of gigs where she sat in with us. Also, we did a, when our harmonica player, Norton Buffalo, passed away from lung cancer in 2009, we did a tribute and a fundraiser for his wife, and to pay off their house and take care of finances and all that stuff. And she was one of the acts, and she sat in with us on that show too. And so I played with her a couple times.
A couple times, stage. Okay.
And she's complimented me on my playing and stuff. But we've never hung.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Hutch is her bass player, and then Marinelli is the guitar player. And you know, they're all buds. In fact, Ivan Neville was performing on Colbert the other night with them, and Ivan sang one of my songs once in a soundtrack movie. But that's another story.
Ah, okay.
Incredible voice.
But yeah, she's I would love to hang out with her all the time, but she's real busy all the time.
Yeah. Well, okay. Let me touch on some other names. Peter Frampton.
Frampton's been our opening act for the last 2 years. Right. He's also opened up for us, you know, 10, 12 years ago, a couple times. Mm-hmm. I know everybody in his band too, and we became, you know, soul brothers on the road, and he would sit in every night with us and do the blues. I think that's what inspired him to want to do this new blues album he has, that we were jamming blues every night. And he was doing great, and he was stretching out, and people were really responding, and he just thought, man, let's do a blues record. You know, so
he just announced recently he's going to quit touring. This is going to be his last tour because of...
he has some kind of a strange... I don't want to say the wrong thing, but it's a very rare...
Neurological condition.
Yeah, and it's going to make it to where his having use of his hands is going to eventually fade away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's too bad. What a match, though, the Peter Frampton Band and Steve Miller. That's really...
Yeah, it was a winner for 2 years. We just had two great years. And this year we're going out with Marty Stewart and the Superlatives.
We were talking about that before we started the podcast. That's going to be right in Venter Robles, right in our
backyard.
August 22nd. And Marty Stewart, Steve Miller Band. Mm-hmm. Incredible matchup.
We're going to do a little more Americana thing this time. So we're going to do a little more of the, you know, the blue, the red states and the, you know, and, you know, the
different flavors.
People that want a little more Americana, you know. And that's fine. Because Steve goes both ways. You know, he has people from both sides of the tracks at his
absolutely.
Shows, and he never gets political, and he has them all together, which is really nice because they all get along.
That's really
but
cool.
The only time that everybody gets along
is a Steve Miller concert.
Because we're not getting along anywhere else. Well, just about any rock show, I would say.
Yeah,
you know, it's one of the, you know, the both sides of the political spectrum come together and they embrace and they put everything away.
That's
and they just enjoy the music. You know?
Right. Isn't it great to have the jewel that is Venter Robles right here in your backyard? Awesome. Yeah, you've got, how many times has Steve Miller Band played there?
I think we played there about three times. Okay. Something like that.
We're definitely going to go to the show.
Oh yeah,
we're definitely going to be there. Man.
I was at the last one you guys played there.
Looking forward to it.
Last couple.
Nice venue.
Can I touch on a couple other names?
Yep.
Brian Wilson.
Brian Wilson. Okay, first time I met him, we were doing a TV show. It was a rock and roll cooking show, variety show, that was going to be sort of like a cross between Living Color, Laugh-In, and, you know, Jules Holland, you know, or something like BBC. Mm-hmm. It was the people that were involved with Living Color, that crew, and they were friends with Scotty Page, my friend who played with Toto, Supertramp, and then eventually with Pink Floyd, saxophone player. Very, very interesting, innovative cat that's always doing something wild. He's doing a thing right now down in L.A. This is wild. We'll get into that in a minute. But he came up with this idea to come up with this variety rock and roll cooking show with a great house band, with a bunch of different cast members, not unlike Laugh-In, you know, like, you know,
Rowan and Martin's Laugh
or Saturday Night Live or whatever, you know, but it was, but we'd bring celebrities on and they would cook a dish and then we'd play with them with a killer band. And the band was like Jeff Porcaro and, you know, Richie Hayward and Lee Sklar and me and Lukather and Jeff Baxter, you know, Lawrence Juber. I mean, it was just like a crazy, and then we had the Tower of Power Horns, you know. So we did a pilot. It was called Rock and Roll Kitchen. And one of the guests was Brian Wilson, and he came on, and this was right when he finally, if you've ever seen the movie, you know, it was right when he was breaking away from Doc Landy, and he was trying to, like, get his life back in order. And another psychologist friend of Scotty's was friends with him, and he was the one that brought him down to the studio, and this was one of the first times he'd actually sat down and just tried to, like, get through a song. And he did Surfer Girl, and we had to do about five or six takes because he just didn't like any of them. And he was very picky, very strange dude. But he came with a dish called Malibu Chicken, which he made, and he kind of loosened up when he started cooking. And I could see the difference between him being on the spot to perform music and then just to do something silly like sit down and make a chicken dish.
You got him in his element.
And he relaxed, and he really came across, and it was really nice. And then the other two guests were Ginger Baker. And the other guest was Mark Andes from Heart. The
bass player. Crazy.
So that was our pilot, and we were way ahead of our time, and Food Network wasn't going yet. And the MC that we had had written the theme, and he kind of come up with the idea, but he should not have been the MC. I think that's what sunk it.
Bummer.
Good idea, wrong time.
Well, we were talking, as you know, last night we were up here in the studio, we were talking about you were going to be coming up. Story about Paul McCartney.
Paul McCartney, the Earth Day, I think 1993.
Yeah, I met Paul twice now. So I have two Paul McCartney stories.
And we saw the clip, and he was on the stage, and he starts, "Hey Jude," or I think it was "Hey Jude."
Yeah, what it came down to is we had a lot of different bands. It was Earth Day at the Bowl, and we were the last act before him, so we kind of were opening for him, and we did an unplugged. It was my first gig back with the band after 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah. I hadn't
Why the break? What happened?
Steve did a jazz album with some cats, like back in Minneapolis with Ben Sidran. He was out supporting that tour. And then his greatest hit CD came out, and man, it started selling like hotcakes. So he had to start putting rock back in the show. You know, when he had to do that, he had to hire some of the old guard to come back.
Thank God for rock back in the show.
Right.
Man.
So in 93, 93? Yeah, 93. Earth Day at the Bowl. We did an unplugged set. I got to meet Paul. It was great. And he said to everybody, not just our band, but the whole cast, because there was, you know, Henley and, God, it was like 10,000 Maniacs. I can't remember all the bands, but, you know, Kenny Loggins. I mean, it was a whole bunch of folks, you know.
He started calling him out. It looked
PM Dawn.
PM Dawn. Set
Adrift on Memory Bliss, baby.
Boy, it's all coming back to me now. But anyway, he said to everybody, "I'm going to be playing, you know, Hey Jude at the United. Like, everybody come out and join me." And so we are already ready for that.
Yeah.
We just didn't know when he was going to do it because he's kind of like Stevie, you know, kind of feels the crowd as he's going through. And they have a set list, but they could, like, change songs and leapfrog or add something, you know.
Yeah.
So we didn't really know when he was going to do it. So we'd already done our set. We were done. Diane and I, we had our new baby at that time. She wasn't a baby, but she was probably about 4 or 5, something like that.
Yeah.
And Norton's wife said, "I'll watch her if you guys want to go over to the side of the stage and watch a little of the show and whatnot." So we went over to the wings, and Diane and I are sitting there. And Diane knows Paul, obviously, from the Sgt. Pepper movie already. Yeah. I just met Paul, so he knew who I was. And we're sitting on the side of the stage looking out from the wings. And that's when he finished this song. He looks over at us because we're right there. He goes, "Diane, Kenny, come on out and join me for this next song." And then he looks over to the left, and Ringo is on the other side. And he goes, "Hey, Ringo, come on out, you know." So we're walking from the sides, and, like, you know, everybody in backstage is going, "Oh my God, he's doing it! We gotta get up there," you know. So they all started, like, getting ready to come out in droves, but we were the first ones.
That's
so
crazy.
We came out, Ringo, me, Diane, and Paul's in the middle, and then we all turn and we look, and CNN takes the shot.
Wow. Wow.
And they actually did a video, which I have a clip of, which I got a hold of for the kids. So there's a scene of us starting Hey Jude, and in the frame is us.
That's nice. Pretty cool.
So yeah. I get to
That's
be,
pretty cool.
I got to kind of be a Beatle for a second, which was kind of nice.
Yeah.
So that was my first, you know, Paul McCartney.
When you mentioned a little bit earlier, you had had an opportunity to play with the Tower Power Horns, or they came on a set you were at, a gig. Did you get to meet Mick Gillette, trumpet player?
No. Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. He played with Tower in my high school senior ball. And I used to go see them.
Yeah.
Like in town here.
When they were our local band, when they were,
well,
before they busted loose.
When they were first coming out.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw them in like 70, 71, I think, at the Whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And this was around the same time that they played our high school, I think, around there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was around there.
Yeah.
Because they were still just kind of getting known.
Yeah.
I think they had, you know, down to the
East Bay Grease, down to the nightclub.
Yeah, I can't. I
some local hits.
It was some other stuff. Yeah. It was not even that yet. I mean, they hadn't gotten into What Is Hip or any of that stuff. They were just getting.
But they created quite a vibe, quite a charge.
So I did see them at the Whiskey in, I think, 70, 71. I think Mick was in the band then.
Yeah.
And then they also played our high school, and I think he was in the band then.
Yeah, okay.
But later on, when I worked with them, he was already gone.
Just checking. Mick was a friend and a good guy.
Yeah.
Real good guy, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, we talked before, you know, we started recording. I brought up about the Mark and Brian show, and you had an opportunity to play with a couple of cool cats. Why don't you share that story? It was one of Brian's birthday shows. Oh, and just to preface this, it was really cool because, you know, I was a music director for a station in Bakersfield, one of my early radio gigs. And we were one of the first two syndicated affiliates for Mark and Brian out of KLOS, us and stationed in Portland. So I got to hang with those guys. I really was a big fan of their show. And I went to multiple Christmas shows, which you were part of the house band for. So I saw you there. But why don't you share that story about Tom Jones? And
Well, you know, Mark and Brian were always doing some crazy stuff. They were kind of like, you know, They were the Howard Stern kind of mentality of the West Coast.
Shock jocks.
Right. Well, I don't know if they were really shock jocks.
They were having fun.
They had warm hearts.
They weren't quite as inappropriate.
Their balls did get snipped off after Disney bought ABC, though. They lost their edge a little bit.
Yeah.
They had fun. They had fun.
Oh, yes. They were great. Oh, yes. Man, they were so fun. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was actually kind of innocent. It was a birthday party for Brian, and Mark knew that Brian's favorite live entertainers, not necessarily rock bands, but just live entertainers, were Tom Jones and Wayne Newton, of all people.
Yeah.
Very Vegas. And so what happened was Mark surprised Brian with a birthday event that happened in Royce Hall, UCLA, 6 a.m., right in the morning for the morning drive, right when they were opening up the show. In effect, Brian was blindfolded on stage. He didn't know what was going on. And they would bring a celebrity on stage, one of these guys, and he had to question them. But they could disguise their voice if they wanted to. So it was the subject matter of the questions that would determine whether he'd be able to figure out who they were. Yeah. And it took him a while, but he finally ended up guessing Tom Jones. We played Not Unusual with our band. It was already set up there. We already had charts and stuff. And it was all who's who band of all the cats, you know. And then they did it now with Wayne Newton. And it took him a while to figure that out. And then when he came up, we did Donkey Shane or whatever. Whatever his hit was or whatever.
Right.
So that was very, very interesting. And Brian was very touched by that. And that's when I could see that they had a very good camaraderie and business relationship, which was really cool in the radio business.
Yeah, 25 years in Los Angeles radio, or 25 years on any station, is amazing. So they were on KLOS last week doing a afternoon reunion show, which was really cool to listen to.
But the best part is that I got to put Wayne Newton and Tom Jones on my bio.
That's pretty crazy.
Because people always go, what the hell? You know?
But did you back up Bobby Sherman at one of the Hollywood Palladium Christmas shows? That's the question.
Now you're digging. Now you're digging,
if I was
Frank.
In the house, man, I probably did.
You put that on your resume,
I think,
too?
I do remember that. That's yeah.
Funny. I was ever there.
He was also one of my clients when I used to work at Guitar Center, which was funny. He used to walk in. I think he became a sheriff out in Riverside County, and he used to come into the Sherman Oaks Guitar Center with his uniform on.
That's crazy.
Trip.
Yeah.
After the fact.
Yeah.
You know, Kenny, you've had up till date nothing less than an amazing career. All the twists and turns, the people you play with and met. And some of the young people in our area, you've had an opportunity to not only play with them, but to impact their lives in small, big ways. My son was in the Modern Music Academy, Darren and Jesse Clark. And he was just talking. I went by to pick up some lights for the studio. And he goes, Dad, say hi to Kenny. He said, we had a blast. He was telling us how he wrote songs and did his thing. And he said, heck of a nice guy. And so you went in there and shared your stuff and made an impression on young people. And to me, that's a powerful thing of what you do is passing along to the next generation.
Definitely. Mm.
Well, it was a really nice thing when I first moved up here. I didn't think they had anything like that in town because it's, you know, a pretty small town. And this Modern Music Academy, is that what it was called?
Yeah.
A nice cat from South Africa or Australia.
Darren and Jesse Clark. Yeah. I don't know.
Oh, they were from
background.
England. That's right.
That's it. England. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And they opened up this music store. It was a music school.
Yes.
It was like School of Rock, but it was serious. It wasn't like a goofy School of Rock. It was like for real.
The real deal.
And they hired me to do a couple, you know, weekend speeches, whatnot. And I met all these kids. And in fact, Alec Van Brash, the guy you just met, he's been doing a lot of singer-songwriter stuff with Uncork the Mic with Michelle Morrow the last few weeks. And
that's cool.
he's getting stronger. He came in and sang the other day, man. It was like, great. I got like takes really fast. Because I said, you got to go out and sing more, you know, like get your diaphragm.
Do
and
your thing.
So he's, and his songs are great.
He's good.
He's an incredible artist. So he's got a whole 360 package he's working on right now.
He's a good guy. He came to the show up at DMB's, man.
Yeah. So keep your eyes open for Alex Van Brash. He'll probably change his name. I won't reveal that. I'll let him do that.
But the stage name coming up.
So yeah, the stage name coming.
The Cuesta College Monday Night Band. Is that something you've been involved in?
The night band. That one semester where Dave Becker was the director and he asked me to play guitar and I got my big box out and got my reading chops back up and went up there and we were playing like Buddy Rich arrangements. And all kinds of other stuff, and it was fun. And I got to play a lot of heads with the lead trumpets and stuff, and then they kind of like let me plug in a wah wah and do like a funky wah wah thing with the band or something. But I cut the gig because I used to do that in college when I was about 17, 18 up in Sacramento. So I got to go back to those roots and kind of finish that part of my life that I never did by doing that. And we have a video of that performance which I treasure and I have at my
house. Well, hey, there's a connection I think that comes from that I have. His dad was Greg Mitchell, who I knew doing Cuesta College Radio way back in the day, how I first got in. But Jeff Mitchell, he's a Facebook friend of yours, and he's a cool kid.
He was one of the first artists that I produced in town.
Really cool kid, great, great player himself. Mm-hmm. And I see you guys have a connection on social media.
Yeah, they had a band called Derailed.
Derailed.
And he brought them to the house. That was the first thing I did when I first moved up here was record those guys in this garage. And we did pretty good. It sounded nice. I mean, I had fun doing it, and it was a great experience for me because I never had taken somebody like that in the band into the studio, and it just had to completely like mold them, like a Svengali,
Right.
And we came up with four tracks, and I thought it sounded really
cool.
Good.
Well, I saw that his dad passed, Greg. Saw that you contributed to that, and they had a Greg Fest at the park that I went to, which was really cool. So I commend you for that. That's just another touching and a giving heart that you have.
Right. Well, he was around when we were recording, and he was a part of that.
Yeah. That's special, man.
And Kenny, recently you've done some production for the Cody Blackbird Band. Did I get that right?
Yep.
Yeah, we were looking at some videos last night. And give us a nickel's worth on how you got connected to those guys.
We started out with just a Facebook friendship through Joseph Wooten, our keyboard player in the Steve Miller Band. And then they kind of befriended me. And we started talking. And they just seemed kind of interesting. I didn't know much about their music, but I knew that he played native flute, which is something I had an interest in because of my native roots that I keep working on. And they were coming through Chicago, and I was just happened to be there with a day off, and I said, hey, well, let's go out and have some chili dogs, And so I took the band out. They were starving, of course, on the road, doing their stuff, so I bought them lunch, and they just had a great time, and we got to be friends. And then they came to here. They came to SLO to play. They played at Frog and Peach, of all places. And I thought, well, I guess I'll go down and check them out, and I went down. And, they were very rough. They were kind of, they didn't have a traps drummer. The one guy just kind of played percussion. They had a guitar player playing through pedals with an acoustic. No bass, just it was like flute, guitar, and percussion and harmonies. But this native flute. Mm-hmm. And then the songs they were writing were a little bit anarchist, had messages. And every time I'd been to the Frog and Peach, those college kids are picking up on each other. They want to get drunk and have fun after they do their homework.
Oh, yeah.
So they're not interested in the entertainment very often. Yeah. They're just kind of up at the bar hanging out and talking to one another.
Yeah.
I watched these guys start playing. I'm in the corner, I'm just being an observer. And these kids stopped talking to one another and walked out onto the dance floor and stood in front of them and just stared at them.
They engaged
while
the
they
audience.
Were playing.
Wow!
And they were out of tune and they were kind of out of time, and I didn't really understand some of the lyrics. And I was just kind of going, you know what? I got to throw all my old preconceived perfectionist music industry bullshit and throw it out the window because it doesn't matter now. What matters is the music and what these kids are communicating with their art and their message. And I sat there and I took a lesson and I went like, God, these guys are, you know, I wouldn't be able to go up with my band and entertain those kids like that.
Wow.
They probably wouldn't even care about us old farts up there doing blues.
Wow. But something about Cody Blackbird and the...
Then they're all in their 20s, so they looked like them. Yeah. So they related to them. They all had stingy brim hats, you know, and the goatees. And, you know. Yeah, they were hipsters, you know.
Yeah.
But they were Native American at the same time. And at that time, they had a song that was called The Black Snake. They were talking about the pipeline at Standing Rock, and they were really activists. And then eventually they came and they played Last Stage West. And so I said, well, why don't I bring my fretless ukulele and my little mandolin, my mantar is what I call it.
Yeah.
And I'll sit in with you guys. We'll have some fun. So we did. There wasn't a lot of people there, but we had a great time.
Yeah.
And then that's when we start this relationship as musical relationship. And we ended up getting a studio up in the Bay Area for free. And they asked me to produce it.
Wow.
And it was not far from my manager's house, so I just went and stayed with my manager.
Nice.
So that was fun.
Nice. Right.
And then in the daytime, I was producing these guys for 3 days, and we cut like 12 tracks. And that's the record that's for sale now called Time. And one of the tracks that we did on there was Time by the Chambers Brothers.
Yeah.
Because that fits them for some reason.
For some reason.
Cool.
Yeah. And you could even do Doors tunes with these guys, because the lead singer sounds like Jim Morrison when he gets going.
So for our listeners, again, that's the Cody Blackbird Band.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool, man.
Yeah, they're out of Arizona. They're part, you know... Dakota, they're part Gila River, and they also have a little Romanian gypsy in them. So they're very interesting brothers. It's brothers, and they harmonize well together, and it's a magical kind of an experience. And like I said, when he starts playing that native flute, he's got a million of them. He doesn't just play one.
Yeah.
He's got like a trunk of these things. And he gets that flute going, and people just kind of like go, you know, you ever hear those little pipe bands that are at the fairs, you know, they're from South America, and they get real mesmerizing. You're listening to me, you're like,
it draws you in.
That's what
they've
this
got
does.
That happening.
But they're doing it with rock and roll.
That's pretty crazy.
And anarchist lyrics.
I'm looking forward to hearing more of those guys.
Yeah.
So we got a new one we just cut at the house, and they're putting some overdubs with some guest artists on it right now. And then they're going to send me the hard drive back in a while, and I'll mix that, and that'll be a new album.
Oh, that's cool. We're looking forward to hearing that. And of course, Living in Slow Good Life. You can drive to LA. You can drive to the Bay Area. We're in the center of everything right here.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool.
What brought you to San Luis Obispo?
What he just said.
That's it. I mean, what made you have it become your permanent residence?
Something about a tax attorney.
Well, Diane and I were looking for a change anyway. Our kids were getting older. They were starting to go to high school and stuff, and we didn't want them going to the particular high school in Woodland Hills where we were living at the time. Taft High was having some problems, typical LA Unified, and they eliminated their music program.
Oh,
so I said, you know what? Let's get out of here. So we went up to Santa Clarita, went up to William Hart. They had a music program. Our daughter did really well on trumpet and tuba there. And our youngest that was coming up, at that time, Steve took some time off. I was working at Guitar Center in Hollywood, having to drive over Newhall Pass, and oh, God, the traffic and the heat and the fires and... I just said, you know, let's go somewhere else. So we started looking at San Diego and, you know, those areas all the way up through Solano Beach and Carlsbad. Then we started going north. We looked at, you know, Santa Barbara, you know, Carpinteria. And to answer your question, our accountant had moved up to Napomo and kind of retired, even though she was still doing our taxes. She kind of like got away from, you know, the brick and mortar. And she was a lawyer as well. But she wanted to kind of semi-retire, so she bought a little 5-acre ranch off of, you know, Willow, you know, in Napomo. And I used to have to do my taxes at the end of the year because I was out touring all summer, so I didn't have time to get my taxes done in the spring because we usually do a spring tour, too. So I'd have to push it to the summer, go on an extension, and, of course, it would go on forever because we would tour all the way through September. And so you can extend, I think, all the way out to October. And so I said, well, you know, let's get our taxes done. Let's go up and sign them, blah, 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 blah. And I came up to Napomo. It was October. it was like cold and foggy yeah. and kind of nice. And down where we lived, it was like hell, like 105 heat. It was like tons of traffic and rotten right. people, you know.
Right.
And I just kind of went, you know what? Maybe we should go check this area, you know. Yeah. So then we started looking at homes next mm-hmm. door to her, mm-hmm. which were Centex homes. We went over to this grove that was on over by the Chevron refinery off Willow. Mm-hmm. They had another one there. We couldn't seem to get a lot in time. It was like right around 2005, 2006 when everybody was buying up everything. Mm-hmm. It was just before The Big Short.
Mm-hmm.
And your real estate was just out of control.
It was going up $10,000
a month. You had to get on a waiting
month.
List if you even wanted to get a crappy lot, you yeah. know. Yeah. So we missed out on all those lots. And so we just kind of like, wow, because they were like one-story homes with casitas, and they were like less than $1 million on an acre, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was like, wow, in L.A., they'd be like $4 million, you know. And so they had this one other development that was going in right off Foothill and Los Osos Valley Road, which was another Centex development called Valley Vista. Mm-hmm. And they were a little more expensive, but it was near town, which is kind of nice yeah. because where they were out there in Willow is like, that's kind of where that Shea Home trilogy yeah. is yeah. now. You yeah. know?
It's a little bit yeah. far out.
They have yeah, to have their own little grocery store. Yeah. They're yeah. they're kind of isolated yeah. out there. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this was closer to town, you know. So we bought one of those homes as a spec home, just to invest with, and we ended up eventually moving into it. And, right. and after battling Bank of America for years, you know, on a hardship loan thing, we finally were able to sue them in open court and make them give us money and give us a great
wow.
loan.
Oh,
and
nice.
I had to get the shark lawyer from Century City to do it.
Wow. Oh. Wow, you've got a story there. Yeah. Thank God that's
story.
Over, right?
Yeah. 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 No, yeah. We won in yeah. court over Bank of America. They had to pay us damages.
Mm.
Yeah. Bank of America.
B of A.
Evil. Mm. Evil. Mm.
We could go down that cul-de-sac. We ain't going to go there tonight.
They're not one of your sponsors, are they?
This is not the... Well, no, and they never will be. This is not the slow hell life. It's the slow good life. So
just checking. To
declare it, no way, no way. We could use some sponsorship. Right now, we have Slow Talk Podcasting and Marketing sponsoring this podcast. Thank you for bringing that up, Canny. Check out Slow Talk Podcasting at slowtalkpodcasting.com. Your turnkey solution for podcast development, recording, marketing and distribution.
Hey,
SlowTalkPodcasting.com. Be sure to check out The Slow Good Life for the second part of this interview with Canny Lee Lewis. That'll be dropped next week on The Slow Good Life. This episode of The Slow Good Life is brought to you by Slow Talk Podcasting, a turnkey recording studio featuring podcast development, production, distribution, and marketing. Check out Slow Talk Podcasting online at slowtalkpodcasting.com or call them at 805-234-5056.